Chapter 12. Putin's Soul. On the afternoon of September 11, 2001, Putin assembled 48 journalists in the Kremlin to bestow upon them the honors of the state, a tradition from Soviet times. In his brief remarks before the television cameras, he singled out the war correspondents who reported from Chechnya and who thus confronted the well-organized and generously paid propaganda warfare of the rebels. The peace process is gaining momentum there largely through your achievements, he told them. The man who had neutered the only private television network and the only state network that displayed independence then declared the media an important pillar of the new Russia. Huge political and economic changes would be impossible in Russia without its free mass media, he said. The ceremony had just ended when his security aide summoned him to a conference room where they watched television reports of the commercial airliners that crashed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, an attack carried out by Al-Qaeda, the organization that the Russians had long argued provided assistance to Chechnya's rebels. Putin turned to Sergei Ivanov, his old KGB colleague and friend. What can we do to help them? He asked. Many later viewed Putin's response as cynical, but in the hours after the attacks, he acted with alacrity and purpose to help a country he viewed with lingering suspicion. He tried to telephone President George W. Bush, but could not reach him as Air Force One hopscotched the United States. When Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, tried to call Ivanov, Putin immediately took the receiver. He assured her he would not increase Russia's military alert in response to the American move to a war footing. In fact, he lowered the alert and canceled a military exercise in the Pacific Ocean that had begun the previous day, simulating a nuclear conflict with the United States. Is there anything else we can do? He asked Rice. A thought flashed through her mind. The Cold War really is over. Putin was the first world leader to call the White House, even before the extent of the attack was clear. He later telephoned Prime Minister Tony Blair in Britain and Chancellor Gerhard Schröder in Germany, repeating that the world must unite against the scourge of terrorism. In contrast to his cautious silence after the Kursk disaster and other major events, Putin went on television and expressed his condolences to the victims of what he called an unprecedented act of aggression. The event that occurred in the United States today goes beyond national borders. It is a brazen challenge to the whole of humanity, at least to civilized humanity, he said. He made it clear that the tragedy was an opportunity to refashion international relations, to fight the plague of the 21st century. Russia knows firsthand what terrorism is, he said. So we understand, as well as anyone, the feelings of the American people. Addressing the people of the United States on behalf of Russia, I would like to say that we are with you. We entirely and fully share and experience your pain. By the time Bush called back on September 12th, Putin had decreed a moment of silence in solidarity, setting a tone from the top that for a time at least tempered the virulent anti-American sentiment that infused Russian politics. Only 2 years after the anti-American protests against the NATO war in Serbia, many Russians, though certainly not all, followed Putin's lead. They piled flowers outside the American embassy, and the tone of state television, where the Kremlin's mood increasingly manifested itself, shifted markedly. Good will triumph over evil, Putin told Bush. I want you to know that in this struggle, we will stand together. Putin's response seemed to validate Bush's initial impression of him, which no one had anticipated when the new administration began. During his campaign against Al Gore in 2000, Bush had denounced the war in Chechnya with as much vehemence as Clinton ever had, seeing it as a way of portraying the Democrats as having been soft on Russia. From Bush's very first days in office, relations with Putin's Russia appeared fraught. In January 2001, American border agents, acting on an international warrant, had arrested Pavel Borodin when he landed in New York. After taking office, Putin had quietly transferred Borodin out of his post overseeing Kremlin property and given him a largely ceremonial assignment as an envoy to the Union State of Russia and Belarus, an entity formed in 1996 but never realized. Russia's new prosecutor, Vladimir Ustinov, quietly closed the investigation of Borodin's activities, but the Swiss had not closed its case. Carla Del Ponte had circulated the warrant that snared Borodin, accusing him of accepting kickbacks of approximately $30 million from the contracts he had issued to renovate the Grand Palace at the Kremlin and the accounting chamber. The scandal that had tarnished the Yeltsin presidency now cast such a shadow over relations with the new American president that it was the subject of Putin's first phone call with Bush on January 31, 2001. Within weeks, relations seemed doomed to worsen. In February, the FBI finally uncovered a long-suspected mole within its ranks. Robert Hansen, a senior counterintelligence supervisor, had spied for the Soviet Union and then Russia until the evening of his arrest. His exposure led to the expulsion of 50 Russian diplomats from the United States, followed by the tit-for-tat expulsion of 50 Americans from Moscow. For a time, the Cold War seemed to take on a new life. But when Bush and Putin met for the first time in June 2001 at Brdo Castle, a 16th-century villa outside Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana, both men seemed eager to defuse the mounting tensions. And both turned to their intelligence briefings in hopes of breaking the ice. Putin greeted Bush by mentioning rugby, which Bush had played for a year in college. "I did play rugby," Bush told him, knowingly. "Very good briefing." Then, as Putin got down to business, reading through his agenda from a stack of note cards, Bush interrupted and asked about the cross Putin's mother had given him to bless in Jerusalem. Bush saw the surprise in Putin's face, though it quickly passed. Bush explained that he had read about the story without mentioning that it was contained in his own briefing book, prepared by the CIA. Putin recounted the story of the fire at his dacha, recreating for him the moment when a worker found the cross in the ashes and presented it to him as if it was meant to be. Bush, a believer, told him, "Vladimir, that is the story of the cross." When the two emerged to meet the press after 2 hours of meetings, they had resolved few of their differences, especially over Russia's opposition to missile defenses, which Bush pursued far more aggressively than his Democratic predecessor, but they exuded a personal warmth that was striking given recent events. Bush called him a remarkable leader, and, in contrast to what the Russians viewed as Clinton's carping, he made only passing mention of Chechnya or freedom of speech in Russia. When asked if Americans could trust Putin, given their differences over a plethora of issues, Bush said he would not have invited him to his ranch in Texas the following November if he did not think so. "I looked the man in the eye," Bush said. "I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul, a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country." Neither Bush nor Putin mentioned the story of the cross or the fact that Putin was not wearing it that day, as he had told his biographers he did every day. He did bring it with him when he and Bush met again at the Group of Eight summit in Genoa the next month. Not everyone was convinced by this fledgling partnership. "I can understand the strategy on rapport, but it went too far," Michael McFaul, an American academic who first met Putin in Petersburg before the collapse of the Soviet Union, told a newspaper. "I think there is plenty of good reason not to trust President Putin. This is a man who was trained to lie." Putin traveled to 18 countries in his first year in office, often with Ludmila. He projected the image of a new Russia eager to engage the world and erase some of the vestiges of the Cold War. After his initial focus on policies at home, he overhauled Russia's foreign policy in ways that Yeltsin never could, weakened as he had been by the communists and nationalists still nostalgic for the lost superpower that was the Soviet Union. What Putin sought was nothing less than a rapprochement with the West, especially with Europe. But even with the main adversary, he had been trained to fight as an intelligence officer. In 2001, he closed Soviet-era military outposts overseas, including a massive eavesdropping post in Lourdes, Cuba, and a naval and intelligence base in Vietnam, vowing that the new Russia should focus its resources instead on building up its military to counter the more pressing threat of Islamic extremism in the Northern Caucasus. After the attacks of September 11th, Putin softened his public opposition to the enlargement of NATO, the next round of which would extend membership to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, the three Baltic republics that had been annexed by the Soviet Union and still included sizable Russian populations. As a candidate in March 2000, Putin had even suggested that Russia might one day join NATO. As the United States went to war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in October, Putin provided not only Russian intelligence, but also money and weapons to the Northern Alliance. The Afghans, who had continued to resist the Taliban after it seized power in 1996, and before that had fought against the Soviet invasion. Putin also acquiesced in the establishment of American military bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, the first deployment of American soldiers to any part of the former Soviet Union since the Great Patriotic War. Putin's moves face resistance from Russia's military, a hidebound bureaucracy that, more than most parts of society, had not shed its Soviet heritage. It was now a decrepit force, vastly reduced from the 2.8 million personnel at the end of the Soviet era to barely 1 million, and after the 1990s, a deeply corrupted one. The majority of soldiers were conscripts subject to a brutal form of hazing by older soldiers known as dedovshchina, from the word for grandfather. Conditions in the military were so bad that most Russian families did whatever they could, from bribes to faked illnesses to emigration, to keep their sons out of the draft. Crime and corruption infected the ranks from top to bottom, with commanders renting out conscripts as serfs and selling off their units' fuel, spare parts, and even vehicles. Although he favored warships and fighter jets as backdrops for his popular image, Putin was not a military man. In Soviet times, the soldiers and officers of the Red Army had disdained the elite agents of the KGB, and the feeling was often mutual. The military, though, lay at the heart of Putin's mission to restore the nation, and he understood the sorry state it was in. Though eager to introduce a new military doctrine and turn the military into a leaner, more modern, and more disciplined professional force, Putin moved cautiously to impose his vision on the one institution that still had a measure of independence, despite its diminished standing. Putin barely mentioned military policy in his first months in office, beyond the strategy for winning the war in Chechnya. Some military analysts in Russia pronounced Putin weak or aloof. Others saw a Machiavellian strategy to allow rival commanders to batter themselves into such a weakened state that they would have to submit to Putin. Putin prefers to deal with people who have been politically hamstrung, feel constrained, and thus have to stay loyal to the president, a prominent military analyst wrote. After the Kursk disaster, Putin resisted the expedient political move of dismissing the commanders whose incompetence and lies had dented his popularity. He proved far more calculating, building popular support and boosting morale by raising the salaries of soldiers and pledging more money for the military, even as he ordered a restructuring of the armed forces that would further reduce the number of troops. Putin restored the Red Banner as the army standard, now with the Tsarist double eagle and the music of the Soviet national anthem, though with new words. The anthem adopted after the collapse of the Soviet Union contained no lyrics, and athletes at the Summer Olympics in Sydney in 2000 had complained to Putin that they could not sing along when they stood on the podium to receive their medals. Such moves proved deft. They appealed to the nostalgic patriotism of the military and large swaths of society without restoring the Soviet ideology that many Russians were happy to put behind them. Putin might have been a political novice, but he found a balance between the conflicted past and the uncertain future, one that came naturally because it very much reflected his own views. He did not rail against the Soviet system the way Yeltsin had, but instead co-opted the parts of its history that served his idea of the new Russia. During a call-in with voters in February 2000, he used an aphorism that has been widely attributed to him, but was not, in fact, his own. "Anyone who does not regret the collapse of the Soviet Union has no heart," he said. "And anyone who wants to see it recreated in its former shape has no brain." Putin himself seemed suspended between his impulses. He kept Felix Dzerzhinsky's statue on his desk at the FSB, but opposed public appeals to restore the man's bronze monument to the traffic circle where it stood in front of Lubyanka. He glorified the Soviet victory in the Great Patriotic War, but when asked to do so, he refused to restore the wartime name of Volgograd, the site of the terrible siege far better known as Stalingrad. Despite Putin's criticism of the failures of the Soviet past, his embrace of some of its symbols raised alarms among intellectuals and liberals. A group of prominent artists and writers published an open letter to him warning of the dangers of restoring the Soviet anthem. "The head of state must be clearly aware that millions of fellow citizens, including those who voted for him, will never come to respect an anthem that flouts their convictions and insults the memory of the victims of Soviet political repressions," they wrote. Boris Yeltsin, criticizing his successor for the first time since he left office, said the music was associated in his mind with Soviet bureaucrats attending Communist Party congresses. "The president of a country should not blindly follow the mood of the people," Yeltsin told Komsomolskaya Pravda. "On the contrary, it is up to him to actively influence it." Putin did influence the mood, sampling the past as if from a buffet, picking and choosing a history that he presented to a society deeply divided over what it represented. Putin had been in office a year before he moved, abruptly and surgically, to bring the recalcitrant military command under his control. The Minister of Defense, Marshal Igor Sergeyev, had already passed retirement age, but he extended his term annually by appealing first to Yeltsin and then to Putin in 2000. Sergeyev, then 63, assumed that his reappointment in early 2001 would again be a mere formality. Like Yeltsin before him, Putin favored secrecy and surprise in the timing of his announcements. Only his trusted advisors knew of his plan, and Sergeyev was not among them. Otherwise, he would not have miscalculated the level of support he actually had in the Kremlin. On March 28th, Putin assembled his national security team at the Kremlin and announced that Sergei Ivanov would take over as Minister of Defense. Ivanov was so close to Putin that he was sometimes described as an alter ego. Thin and pale, his hair parted sharply on the left, his face perpetually pinched, he had joined the KGB after studying English and Swedish at Leningrad State University. He and Putin met in 1977 at the Big House, where they worked together for 2 years before Ivanov's career took off. He attended the Red Banner Institute outside Moscow, and by 1981 had emerged as a foreign intelligence operative who served under diplomatic cover in Soviet embassies in Finland, Sweden, and Kenya, and maybe Britain. That his resume remained so opaque underscored the sort of spy he was, and Putin was not. Unlike Putin, he never resigned, rising through the ranks of the post-Soviet Foreign Intelligence Service to become the youngest general in the new Russia. When Putin became director of the FSB, he appointed Ivanov as a deputy. Ivanov later followed him into the Kremlin, where he joined Putin's inner circle of aides, attending the national security meetings held on Mondays, but also the less formal Saturday meetings and the purely social gatherings that occurred at Putin's presidential residence whenever the mood struck, often late into the night. Ivanov was often portrayed as a hardliner, a silovik, who reflected Putin's own experience and conservative views. He certainly shared Putin's goal of remaking a bloated, inefficient military. Having retired from his military rank in the FSB, Ivanov became the first civilian to head the ministry in Soviet or Russian history. As you can see, civilians are coming to take up key positions in military agencies, Putin said when he announced the appointment. This is also a deliberate step. It is a step towards the demilitarization of Russia's social life. Putin's appointment signaled a break with Yeltsin, albeit a modest one. He appointed the first woman to a senior position in the Ministry of Defense, Lyubov Kudyelina, putting her in charge of overseeing the military budget. He replaced the interior minister with another Petersburger, Boris Gritslov, who headed the pro-Putin bloc in the Duma, but he did not demote anyone except the Minister for Nuclear Affairs, Yevgeny Adamov, who was later charged in an American court for embezzling $9 million in funds earmarked to bolster security at nuclear sites. The newspaper Izvestia declared that Putin's team now really has been brought together like a fist. As defense minister, Ivanov watched the prospect of an American intervention on Russia's periphery with alarm. 3 days after the September 11th attacks, Ivanov ruled out even the hypothetical possibility of NATO military operations on the territory of Central Asian nations. Putin, though, felt that the United States now understood the threat of Islamic terrorism and was gratified. He traveled to Germany 2 weeks later and addressed the Bundestag, beginning his remarks in Russian and then shifting to the language of Goethe, of Schiller, and of Kant. "Today, we must state firmly and finally," he said, "the Cold War is over." The German Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, reciprocated by declaring that the world should moderate its criticism of Russia's military operations in Chechnya, even as he pressed Putin privately to intervene in the most prominent military trial involving war crimes by Russian soldiers. When Putin returned to Moscow on September 24th, he went to the Ministry of Defense, a hulking white building on the Boulevard Ring in the city's center, and ordered the commanders to work with the Americans. He overruled Ivanov, who quietly dropped his public opposition to the American operations in Central Asia. Putin expected something for his acquiescence to a post-Cold War order. He invested heavily in developing a personal relationship with Bush. Already the first Russian or Soviet leader since Lenin to speak a foreign language, he took lessons in English for an hour a day, learning the language of American diplomacy and commerce, and he used his rudimentary skill to speak privately with Bush and to break the ice. In Slovenia, walking in the garden, he remarked on the commonalities between them. "I see you named your daughters after your mother and your mother-in-law." When Bush replied, "Aren't I a good diplomat?" Putin laughed and said, "I did the same thing." In private, he felt he could be candid with Bush about their differences, trying to make him understand the difficulties that Russia, that he, faced in the transition from the Soviet ruins. He sought some kind of accommodation with the United States, even with NATO. When he met Bush again on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Shanghai in October, Putin proposed changes in the anti-ballistic missile treaty that would allow some tests of the American missile defense system that Bush coveted, but leave the treaty's main provisions in place for another year or two. He considered the treaty critical to Russia's strategic defense, and a delay would give its scientists time to develop new weapons that would counter the American system. He also pressed Bush to agree to lower the number of nuclear weapons each country had, an essential step for Putin in reducing the costs of sustaining Russia's military. He considered his proposal a sensible compromise, and Bush promised to consider it, but his administration was feeling heady following the invasion of Afghanistan. The Pentagon dug in its heels, balking at Putin's proposal that Russia be notified in advance of each and every test and be allowed to monitor the progress of a defense system that ultimately could negate Russia's standing as a nuclear superpower. When Putin arrived in Washington in November for his first visit to the United States as president, he still imagined a grand bargain was possible. But any hope of one evaporated when he met Bush in the White House. "My God," Putin blurted out when he entered the Oval Office on the morning of November 13th, the light streaming through the south windows. "This is beautiful." Bush, like his aides, never stopped being confounded by the seeming contradictions contained by a former KGB agent from the atheist Soviet Union, and never seemed to imagine that perhaps an agent might use them to his advantage. Bush felt certain that they would overcome the differences of the past. The common cause they had forged over the attacks of September 11th bore fruit in his mind, even as they met. The night before, the Taliban abandoned Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, and retreated in disarray. "This thing just might unravel like a cheap suit," Bush told him. Condoleezza Rice, who speaks Russian, could not be sure of the exact translation, but said Putin roared in approval. The next day, the Putins flew to Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. The Bushes greeted them in a pouring rain, with Lyudmila handing Laura Bush a single yellow rose, a symbol of Texas lore. They stayed in the ranch's guest house next door to the Bushes and arrived at dinner an hour early, forgetting the time change from Washington. When dinner finally began, they ate barbecue and listened to the pianist, Van Cliburn, and a country swing band playing songs like Cotton Eye Joe. Lyudmila wore a dress with red, white, and blue sequins, and when Putin offered a toast, he sounded personally moved. "I've never been to the home of another world leader," he said, adding that the United States was fortunate at such a critical time in its history to have a man of such character at its helm. The down-home camaraderie continued when they met students at Crawford High School the next day, after which Putin flew to New York and visited the ruins of the World Trade Center, still smoldering 2 months after the attack. Then, 3 weeks later, Bush telephoned Putin in Moscow and informed him he was withdrawing from the ABM treaty despite Putin's objections. The only concession that Putin wrested from him after 6 months of talks and four meetings between the two leaders was the courtesy of a week's advance notice before Bush announced the move publicly in the middle of December. Throughout the debate over Afghanistan and missile defense, Putin managed to prevent any eruption of nationalist fervor over his quiet accommodation with Bush's actions and policies. Yeltsin had railed against the United States and the West, in part to protect his political flanks. Putin instead co-opted those in Russia most critical of America, cementing his dominance of the parliament in the same slow, stealthy, and methodical way that he had done with the military. One of Putin's first legislative initiatives in 2000 had been a restructuring of the Federation Council, then comprising the governors of the country's 89 regions and their representatives who, as they showed in the Skuratov affair, operated independently of the Kremlin. The move, along with the creation of 7 regional envoys, faced opposition at first, but ultimately succeeded in reigning regional leaders under Putin's control. Over time, the upper house that had tormented Yeltsin became a rubber stamp filled with Putin loyalists. In Putin's first years in office, the Kremlin also controlled an unwieldy majority in the Duma. Some of his early reforms, especially an effort to allow the privatization of agricultural land, still faced opposition. Putin disdained party politics and legislative jockeying, as he had as Anatoly Sobchak's deputy facing Petersburg City Council. To him, the political blocs of the legislative branch should be instruments of the Kremlin's executive. He said he had no desire to recreate a single ruling party that would govern Russia as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had. He intended to create several parties, all effectively reliant on the Kremlin. In July 2001, Putin signed a new election law to reduce the number of parties by requiring memberships of more than 50,000, dispersed through at least half of the country. Ostensibly, the idea was to create a two-party or three-party system, like those in Europe, the only difference being that all the parties would be loyal or at least pliant. Although he professed his commitment to democracy, he had little patience for debates with uncertain outcomes. Unity already shared control of the parliament's committees with the communists, but to consolidate its power, Putin's aides orchestrated a merger with the party of Primakov and Lushkov, unveiling it in a new Congress on December 1, 2001. The new party was to be called United Russia, an organization filled with the officials and bureaucrats of Putin's party of power. The mastermind of the Kremlin's political strategy was Vladislav Surkov, a Chechen-born advertising genius with a background in military intelligence, who in the 1990s had worked for the banks of three of Russia's oligarchs, including Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He joined Alexander Voloshin's staff while Yeltsin was still president, and more than anyone else, he helped craft Putin's public image and engineered his political strategies. He was youthful and deeply cynical, a fan of American rap music. He kept a picture of Tupac Shakur next to one of Putin, and Shakespeare, whose work he considered a font of political inspiration. As a Russian novelist and activist, Eduard Limonov once said, Surkov had turned Russia into a wonderful postmodernist theater, where he experiments with old and new political models. In April 2002, Surkov overturned the Duma's leadership in what became known as the Portfolio Putsch. The Kremlin's allies ousted the communists from the committee posts that Putin had offered them shortly after the elections in 1999, while the communist speaker, Gennady Selezhnev, threw his support to the Kremlin and abandoned his party colleagues. Putin, as aloof as a czar from the petty squabbles of the dukes and boyars, had effectively decapitated the communist leadership. Gennady Zyuganov, the party's chief, who had once seemed a serious threat to Yeltsin's Kremlin, could only sputter in protest. Even when tipsy, Yeltsin had the courage to gather leaders of different factions in critical moments and look for a solution together rather than starting a new war, he said bitterly. The motive for Putin's reshuffling of the legislative leadership became clear 2 weeks later, when he delivered his annual address to the Federal Assembly, which comprised the upper and lower houses of parliament. In the marble hall of the Kremlin Presidium, Putin touted his accomplishments: a drop in unemployment, rising incomes, a balanced budget, Russia's return to its position as the world's second largest oil producer. But he lamented the large and clumsy bureaucracy of the government, the unreformed ministries that still acted as branches of a centralized economy. He needed a parliamentary majority not to debate the issues, but to pass the legislation the Kremlin needed to impose solutions. And for an hour, he listed a host of liberal reforms intended to transform the judiciary, to create a mortgage system to expand the housing market, to end the draft and introduce a professional volunteer military, and to write regulations that would hasten Russia's membership in the World Trade Organization. It was an ambitious agenda, and he now had few obstacles to imposing it. In his speech, Putin devoted barely a minute to the war that he had ridden to power, in part because it was no longer the triumph he had promised. In 2001, Putin announced that the withdrawal of the Russian military from Chechnya would soon begin, but the war was far from over. Federal forces controlled the republic's borders and most of its cities and villages, but only during the day. Attacks from the rebels continued to kill Russian troops, who retaliated with sweeps of villages that resulted in arrests, torture, and death. Although the Kremlin had installed a formal rebel commander and imam, Ahmad Kadyrov, as the Republic's loyalist leader, the military and the FSB could not crush the insurgency. Its leaders remained at large, hiding in the mountains along the border or in villages that remained committed to Chechen independence. The initial popularity of the war had faded. Polls showed that most Russians no longer believed it was winnable. Chechnya threatened to become a quagmire that most felt should be resolved through peace talks. The mounting casualties threatened not only Putin's strategy, but his presidency. The war remained a personal crusade for Putin, and the official propaganda was so successful that he began to believe the sterilized versions of events, falling victim to his own spin. It was only when disaster struck on an enormous scale that the Kremlin's propaganda could not conceal the devastation, and Putin glimpsed the shortcomings of the strategy he had launched and the security bureaucracies he had enlisted to carry them out. On August 19th, an Mi-26 helicopter approached the main Russian military base in Chechnya, the sprawling airfield at Kankala, just outside Grozny. The helicopter, the world's largest, was designed to carry tons of equipment and as many as 80 passengers and crew. But by 1997, the Ministry of Defense had banned its use to ferry passengers, restricting it to cargo. On this day, there were 147 people on board, soldiers and civilians, including the wives of several officers and at least one young boy, the son of an army nurse who had hitched a ride. As the helicopter descended, a missile struck its starboard engine. The helicopter landed 1,000 feet short of its landing pad, right in the middle of a minefield intended to protect the base's perimeter. Loaded with fuel for its return trip, it burst into flames. Most of the passengers who survived the crash landing were trapped inside the burning cabin. Those who made it out tripped mines as they fled. The military reflexively lied about the cause and the casualties, which ultimately reached 127, including the boy and his mother. It was the worst helicopter disaster in history, and the single biggest loss of life in the war, a military catastrophe more deadly than the Kursk. Putin, having learned the hard political lesson of the Kursk, immediately acknowledged the crash and promised an investigation with Sergei Ivanov in charge of it. Ivanov flew the next day to Kankala and relieved the commander of the army's aviation wing, Colonel General Vitaly Pavlov, who protested that he was being scapegoated. Pavlov complained about the maintenance of the helicopter fleet and said the order banning passenger transit applied to peacetime while the country remained at war. "If there is no fighting, why are our troops dying at the hands of militants?" Putin's frustration with his commanders flared. 2 days after the crash, he met in front of television cameras with Sergei Ivanov in the VIP hall of an airport outside Moscow. Aside from his major addresses and press conferences, the televised tête-à-tête became Putin's signature means of communicating, a scripted setting in which he was the unquestioned leader praising, encouraging, or hectoring his subordinates, even a friend as close as Ivanov. How could it happen that despite a defense minister's order banning the use of helicopters of this type from carrying people, people were still being carried? Putin demanded to know. "There is no justification, Vladimir Vladimirovich," Ivanov replied, playing his part in the public censure. 2 weeks later, he forced General Pavlov to submit his resignation and reprimanded 19 other commanders, including 12 generals. The one thing Putin never considered in the wake of the disaster was any change in the war strategy. Although intermediaries had floated proposals for peace talks earlier in the year, Putin continued to rule them out. The only thing Putin would accept from Chechnya's rebels was unconditional surrender. The rebels' response came shortly thereafter in a videotape that showed a shoulder-fired missile downing the helicopter. Despite rumors of his death, the narrator was Aslan Maskadov, surrounded by bearded men he referred to as our Mujahideen. He sat in front of Chechnya's green flag, which no longer bore a wolf, the symbol of the independence struggle for more than a decade. It had been replaced by a sword and a Quranic verse. "We came to the capital of Russia to stop the war," a young man said, speaking thickly and slowly into a camera as he sat cross-legged in front of an open laptop, "or to die here for Allah." The man speaking was Movsar Barayev, a rebel fighter and nephew of one of Chechnya's most ferocious commanders, Arbi Barayev. Russia's military command in the Northern Caucasus had triumphantly announced 2 weeks earlier that Movsar Barayev had been killed on October 10, 2002, ignoring the fact that his death had already been announced a year before that. Now Barayev was in Moscow, barely 3.5 miles from the Kremlin, where Putin, as was his custom, was working late in his office. Putin would not leave for the next 3 days. Barayev, 3 days shy of his 23rd birthday, was the public face of a special detachment of fighters, 22 men and 19 women, who had arrived in Moscow a month earlier, traveling individually or in pairs on trains and buses from Dagestan, to avoid the scrutiny of police wary of travelers from the Caucasus. They came on the orders, he said, of Chechnya's supreme military emir, Shamil Basayev, though they professed grudging loyalty to its putative president, Aslan Maskadov. They spent weeks in Moscow preparing for an assault that would bring the bloody, brutal war to the capital. They wanted a public place that would ensure a mass hostage-taking of ordinary Russians. They considered the parliament, but settled on a theater. The one they chose was on Dubrovka Street in southwest Moscow, a hall still known by its Soviet name, the Palace of Culture for the State Ball-Bearing Factory No. 1. A part of the building housed a gay club, frequented by members of parliament, prominent businessmen, and politicians, it was said, that was undergoing renovation. The fighters of Barayev's group disguised themselves as construction workers and made plans to storm the theater. The theater was showing Russia's first Broadway-style musical, Nord-Ost, based on a popular Soviet novel, The Two Captains, by Veniamin Kaverin. The story was a romantic melodrama, spanning the first half of the 20th century, the exploration of the Arctic, and the siege of Leningrad in the Great Patriotic War. The musical's creator, Georgi Vasilyev, spent $4 million to produce it and promote it on billboards ubiquitously plastered across the city. He calculated that Russia's new middle class, the beneficiaries of the economic boom that Putin was riding to popularity, had grown prosperous enough to afford the $15 ticket price. On the night of its 323rd performance, October 23, 2002, the Chechens moved in just as the second act began. The actors, dressed as pilots in vintage uniforms of the Red Army Air Force, were tap-dancing across the stage when a masked man in camouflage entered from stage left. The closest actor jolted in shock, but most of the audience thought it was a part of the performance, until the gunman fired his AK-47 into the roof and more camouflaged men joined him on the stage. Barayev's fighter sealed off the main hall and wired explosives to columns supporting the theater's balcony. The women, dressed in black hijabs with Arabic inscriptions, took up positions among the audience. They carried pistols and wore belts of what appeared to be explosives, which they threatened to detonate if anyone resisted or the authorities dared to storm the building. The women, as young as 19, became known as Black Widows, the wives, daughters, and sisters of Chechen fighters who had died in the war. In all the years of fighting in Chechnya, suicide bombings had been rare, and the women proved to be a terrifying portent of the turn the war in Chechnya was taking. "We are on Allah's path," one of them declared. If we die here, that won't be the end of it. There are many of us, and it will go on. There were 912 people inside, including the cast and crew, and foreigners from Europe and the United States. The siege unfolded over the next 2 days in a surreal, televised spectacle. Barayev told the captives they could use their phones to call their loved ones and tell them that they would die if the authorities did not end the war in Chechnya. Now Putin was besieged too. He had vowed to wipe out Chechnya's bandits, but the war had ground on for 3 years, devouring Russian soldiers and thousands of Chechens. He had lost the popular support for the war he cultivated at the outset. The military had failed to subdue the insurgency. And now, the FSB had failed spectacularly to stop a terrorist raid in the heart of Moscow. Putin canceled plans to travel to Germany, Portugal, and then to Mexico, where he was to meet George Bush again. Meeting the director of the FSB, Nikolai Patrushev, he ordered preparations for an assault on the theater, authorizing negotiations only if it would buy time. The FSB dispatched 3 teams of commandos to the scene. Only his prime minister, Mikhail Kazyanov, protested that a rescue could result in hundreds of deaths. Putin sent him in his place to the international gathering in Mexico, apparently to get him out of the way. Several prominent politicians, journalists, and officials, including the Chechen representative in the Duma, Aslanbek Aslakhanov, telephoned the captors inside and eventually were allowed in to negotiate with them. 39 of the hostages were soon released, most of them young children. Grigory Yavlinsky, whose party, Yabloka, was sharply critical of the war, entered the theater that night after seeking approval from the Kremlin, which seemed unable to control the intermediaries going in and out, or the phone calls and later the video of the terrorist demands. He was struck by how very, very young the fighters were. They would have been merely children when the Soviet Union collapsed and Chechnya declared independence in 1991. He doubted they had ever gone to school. All they knew they had learned on the battlefields of the Caucasus. They could barely articulate their demands, let alone negotiate. When they demanded an end to the war, Yavlinsky asked, "What does this mean?" He left frustrated, but hopeful that incremental steps, including the release of more hostages, could at least minimize the casualties. Yavlinsky returned to Putin's office in the Kremlin and took part in a series of meetings with him on the progress of the negotiations. And yet, it became clear to him that Putin also presided over a separate set of meetings with Patrushev and other security officials, and people like him were not invited to attend. On the second day of the siege, conditions in the hall became dire, with the hostages succumbing to hunger, dehydration, exhaustion, and fear. The terrorists shot several people, including a woman who inexplicably ran into the building and an FSB commando who had approached from a patio outside. Even so, intermediaries continued to enter the theater, including Anna Politkovskaya, a journalist whose scathing reports from Chechnya had defied and infuriated the military and the Kremlin. She and a prominent physician, Leonid Rashal, managed to persuade a fighter who called himself Abu Bakr to allow her to return with boxes of juice for the hostages. Politkovskaya, born in New York to Soviet diplomats posted at the United Nations, was one of the most courageous Russian journalists who covered the war, and by then she had become an eloquent, impassioned critic of it. Her report sympathized with all who suffered, Russia's conscripts, the rebels, and the civilians caught in between. But she loathed the military's inept and inhumane commanders, and most of all, the commander-in-chief, who in her mind had orchestrated the entire catastrophe in the Caucasus. Her encounter with Abu Bakr made her legs turn to jelly, but she persuaded him to let her meet 2 of the hostages. One, a journalist named Anna Adrianova, spoke of despair. "We are a second Kursk," she said. More releases seemed imminent. An American hostage, Sandy Booker, was allowed to telephone the American embassy. He told a diplomat there that Baryev had agreed to release the foreigners the next morning. The Kremlin announced that it had summoned Putin's special envoy in the southern region, Viktor Kazantsev. The rebels believed that he would arrive at 10 the next day, but he never boarded a plane to Moscow. The storming of the theater began, on Putin's orders, shortly after 5 o'clock in the morning. The terrorist appeared to have relaxed, anticipating more negotiations the next day. Russian commandos had already infiltrated the building through the gay club and inserted listening devices to learn the position of the terrorists. Fearing explosions that could destroy the building, they were to kill the terrorists, not capture them. An odorless gas began to seep into the main hall, released through the building's ventilation system. It was an aerosolized derivative of a powerful anesthetic, fentanyl, developed by an FSB laboratory. The release of the gas caused confusion among the captors and hostages. Anna Adrianova, the hostage Politkovskaya had met, telephoned the radio station Echo Moskvy and said that the terrorists seemed uncertain but not ready to execute them. "Can you hear us?" she said after shots rang out. "We are all going to be blown to hell." Mysteriously, they were not. The gas put most of the hostages to sleep, while the commandos fought gun battles with terrorists who were not in the main hall or were otherwise unaffected by the gas. The fighting lasted more than an hour before Baryev was cornered on a second-floor landing behind the balcony. All 41 captors died, most from bullets to the head. The rescue seemed to be an unmitigated victory, except that the men who planned and carried out the raid had not given thought to the effect the gas would have on the weakened hostages. The successful raid turned into disaster. The first unconscious victims were brought out at 7 o'clock and laid in rows on the theater's front steps, followed by more and still more. Some had already died, but many more were merely unconscious, left amid the growing piles of corpses. Rescue teams were overwhelmed. They were prepared to treat wounds from bullets or bomb fragments, not people choking on swollen tongues. The authorities had prescribed an antidote to counteract the effects of the gas, but there were not enough doses available. And neither the paramedics on the scene nor the doctors in the hospitals knew how much to administer. In the end, 130 hostages died during the siege, only 5 of them from gunshot wounds. Of the latter, only 2 were hostages inside the theater. The other 3 were the woman who had burst into the theater the first day and 2 other men who were shot as they approached or entered the building during the siege. A doctor who participated in the rescue described the confusion and chaos. "It wasn't an evil plot," he said. "It was just a Soviet mess." Putin delivered a televised statement that night. He had appeared sparingly during the siege, shown only in brief clips of his meeting with his security advisors, members of parliament, and Muslim leaders. He was grave, steely-eyed, and seething with coarse fury, referring to the terrorists as armed scum. He said he had hoped for the release of the hostages, but had prepared for the worst. "An almost impossible thing was accomplished," he went on. "The lives of hundreds upon hundreds of people were saved. We proved that Russia cannot be brought to its knees." In Putin's mind, the rescue had been a victory, though he acknowledged it was a painful one. "We were unable to save everyone," he said, before the authorities had disclosed the horrible toll. "Please forgive us." The horrific siege hardened Putin's views that Russia faced an existential threat. The rebels fighting on the country's flank would, with international support, tear the country apart, and the only answer was to destroy them. Aslan Maskhadov, through a representative at a gathering of Chechens in Copenhagen, denounced the attack and offered to enter peace talks without any conditions, but the Kremlin refused. Instead, Russia's prosecutors issued an international arrest warrant for Maskhadov's representative, an actor-turned-activist Ahmed Zakayev, who had been at the conference. Denmark arrested him, but refused to extradite him a month later, saying the Russians had fabricated the evidence implicating him in the siege. In Putin's mind, the West was now harboring the avowed enemies of Russia. A week after it ended, Shamil Basayev claimed responsibility for the siege, saying he wanted to give Russians a first-hand insight into all the charms of the war unleashed by the Kremlin. Instead of seeking to exploit the apparent rift between Basayev and Maskhadov, Putin refused even to consider the possibility of peace talks now. Some believe that might have been the point of the siege all along. A new round of conspiracy theories arose that Putin's cadre had either orchestrated or done nothing to prevent the siege, exploiting it as they had the apartment bombings 3 years earlier in order to undercut those calling for a negotiated truce. The FSB's opacity deepened the suspicion. Officials refused to discuss how 41 fighters with arms and explosives managed to slip into the capital undetected. They refused to divulge the formula for the gas used to anesthetize those inside the theater. The Duma, under pressure from Putin, refused to authorize an investigation, leaving many of the mysteries forever unsolved. When survivors of the siege sought compensation through the courts, they faced harassment from the authorities and defeat after defeat until they won a measure of justice more than 9 years later. The doubts, even the questions, infuriated Putin. The next month, after a meeting in Brussels with the European Union, a reporter for Le Monde asked him whether the use of landmines in Chechnya killed innocent civilians in addition to the terrorists they were intended to kill. Putin bristled visibly, arguing that Islamic radicals wanted to win Chechnya as part of a worldwide jihad targeting Russia, the United States, and its allies. "If you are a Christian, you are in danger," he replied, his indignation rising uncontrollably. "If you decide to become a Muslim, this won't save you either, because they think that traditional Islam is also hostile to their goals." He went on, his language so crude that the interpreters did not bother to translate. "If you are determined to become a complete Islamic radical and are ready to undergo circumcision, then I invite you to Moscow. We are a multi-confessional nation. We have experts in this sphere as well. I will recommend the operation be conducted so that nothing on you will grow again."